Welcome, everybody, to Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Bowdrin. On the show, we're not just going to break kayfabe on the wrestling business. We're going to break kayfabe on sports, movie, television, music. We're going to break kayfabe on life. On today's show, we're going to be discussing all those things and more with my good friend, John Hitchcock. Johnny Hitch, say hello.
Hello, America. We are ready to do our duty to ruin America's youth.
Exactly. That's what we're here for. Absolutely. So John and I have known each other just for a little historical context. I would say going back to the late 80s, I'm going to give a little credit where it's due. John, in my estimation, was the very first hardcore fan in the sense that John was the first guy to bring signs to the arena. He was well known down in the front row in Greensboro, North Carolina, with a few other nefarious types whose name we won't mention and give them credit. Known as Front Row Section D. John, tell us when that started. Just give me a reminder there.
Well, I think the first time I met you, you guys came up for a pay-per-view. You had a crew. And the thing I remember the most about it was we got Meltzer and Keller and a bunch of guys and you and a bunch of guys front row seats on one side. And you guys kept looking at us like, what are you doing? Because we would stir it up. I mean, there was no doubt about it. Back when we first started going, we would sit anywhere, right? And the first sign I ever made was for Ric Flair, and it was just a little thing, and you know, spell out RIC on a couple of pieces of paper. And we started messing with Tiger Conway because Tiger Conway was out there trying to, you know, get a date. And we started going, Tiger, Tiger, come here, Tiger. And he turned around and smiled and started, and we held up Ric Flair's sign. And he went, oh, man, screw you guys, and went walking off. And I said, you know, people are beginning to notice this. And it became kind of a thing. It became something that we were like, we're going to go, and we're going to cheer for the bad guys, and we're just going to try to stir this thing up as far as we can stir it. And it became a kind of a touch point to a lot of fans because they would go to the shows, and they would go, I wonder what they're going to do next. They really just didn't know.
Yeah. Now you go back quite a ways with Mid-Atlantic wrestling. I think before it even became Mid-Atlantic wrestling, weren't you?
Well, I think my first show was probably around 66 or 67. I was just a kid, and my older brother, his name's Weldon Marshall, but we called him Sparky. And if your name was Weldon Marshall, Sparky's a big step up. Anyway, he was an usher, and it was funny as hell because He said, well, let's go one night. And the main event was the Missouri Mauler, who I loved. I thought the guy was funny as all get out, against Danny Miller. And Danny Miller was the chicken wing crossface guy for the Eastern heavyweight title. And it must have been about 69 or 70 or something. And we went, you know, he took me. And just before we walked in the door, he looked at me and he said, there's two things you got to know about wrestling. One, half the fun is in the ring and the other half is outside the ring. Because outside the ring, you're going to see all the nuttiest people you've ever seen in your life. They all fell off turnip trucks. They're all morons. They're crazy. And just watch them because they're a lot of fun. Little did I know that I'd become one of those people. And then he said, and one more thing you need to know, Brute Bernard's real. Whatever happens, stay away from Brute Bernard because he's crazy. And I was like, what? You know, he's crazy? And he goes, oh, yeah, man. He said he was in the locker room, and one of his jobs was to bring the boys. He always told me he brought them sodas, but turns out he'd go and get them a six pack if they wanted it. And he said he was sitting in the back. He was in the back room in the locker room, and Rip Hawk and Sweet Hansen and Weaver and Becker were all playing cards. And then Brute Bernard would be sitting on a chair by himself. And his job was to go around to everybody and say, hey, you know, you want something? Yeah, I can go get you something. And then he went up to Brute Bernard and Rip Hawk grabbed my brother and pulled him aside and said, look, man, just leave him alone. He's getting ready for the match. He's crazy. And Sparks said he looked at him and Brute Bernard was drooling all over himself. And
was he getting into character or was that just legitimately the way he was?
Well, you know, that's a funny thing because I finally got to have a, thanks to my buddy Wayne Brower, we got a hold of Rip Hawk at one of the Charlotte get-togethers. You know, you guys were there once, and we got to talk to him, and I told him that story, and he goes, I said, was he just working my brother? You know, and he goes, no, John. He said, Brute Bernard was crazy. And I went, hey, what a great profession to have. You know, they hire nut jobs and crazy people and, you know, psychopaths. I mean, this is a wonderful thing. And
he said that,
you know, Brute Bernard was legitimately, there was something wrong with him.
Now, I remember you telling me that the first program that you really got into as a fan was Wahoo and Johnny Valentine. Is that correct?
No, the whole wrestling world in the Mid-Atlantic changed with like three guys. One was the Super Destroyer. He was the first big guy who came into the area as a single. Up until then, everything was tag team. You know, the Kentuckians, Aldo Boggy and Bronco Lubitsch, the Infernos, the Bolos.
Exactly. I mean,
and then suddenly here comes this one guy, and he was the guy that was the first guy we ever saw that would walk the ropes, and he would step on the second rope, come down and drop an elbow on people.
Now, this was Don Jardine. This was Don Jardine.
Yes, that's right. You know, it's funny. The reason why I know it's Don Jardine is something happened in the middle, about a couple of years after he was in the Mid-Atlantic, and he was fired and told to leave, you know, leave Crockett's territory. And on the TV show, they announced that Rufus R. Jones had kicked his ass, and this is what he looked like. And they showed a picture of him with his mask off, claiming that Rufus beat his ass up and took his mask off of him.
Wow.
And we're like, there's no way Rufus R. Jones could beat that guy. That guy was unbeatable. He was about 6'6" and about 275. You know, he's the guy that taught the Undertaker how to, you know, walk the ropes and all that stuff. I mean, this guy was serious business. But, you know, they did probably the most important guys are Wahoo and Johnny Valentine. And the talk about wrestlers being artists and the bookers having the element of genius. You know, those guys don't have stuntmen. They are stuntmen. They do everything. And it's one take, right? You know what I mean, Jeff? It's like one take and you have to do it and do it right. If you don't, you know, you get the master blaster, you know, you get the ding dong, you get something so stupid that you go, who's the idiot who did that? Well, they set up a program where Valentine had established himself as the Mid-Atlantic champion. He had a big bowl of silver dollars and anybody could challenge him for the silver dollars. And he would just shellack people. I mean, hard to explain to people nowadays, but you know, Valentine was probably about 6'2", 6'3", probably about 265, 260, chiseled. I mean, just chiseled. He was just a bronze, just a serious badass guy. You know, in Florida, it's like, kind of like think Buddy Colt. You know what I mean? I mean, you wouldn't want to mess with him in a million years. Johnny Valentine once messed with me so bad. I was sitting in the upper deck, and Johnny Valentine comes walking out, and he did everything slow. He was methodical. And he walked out to the ring, and I stood up and started clapping for him, right? And Valentine suddenly saw me, and he stared at me the whole time. And I tried to laugh it off, you know? I mean, like, you know, laugh it off, like, oh, yeah. And then I kept clapping for him, and he kept looking at me. And he was mad, and he kept looking at me. And I finally got up out of my chair and walked away. And then when I started to walk away, I said, hey, you dumbass, you're in the upper deck. It's not like the guy could hit you. But that's how intimidating the guy was. I mean, he had an air. He had an atmosphere that was like nobody's business.
Well, you know, Johnny Valentine, I know, has famously been quoted as saying that he could not make people believe that wrestling was real, but he could make people believe that he was real.
Oh, there's no doubt. No doubt. They set up, George Scott was the booker, but they set up this angle. Where, you know, after a while, Johnny Valentine was basically just crushing people, right? And they had this match on television where Tim Woods, Mr. Wrestling, no mask, comes out and challenges Valentine for a title shot. And Valentine, of course, goes, you know, you guys are bringing in a ringer. You know, this isn't fair. So they have the match, and it's like Valentine's selling for people, and Valentine didn't sell shit. I mean, he was just like the guy who took the punches, the way Gordon Soley used to say, you know, the human chest, where you take three punches to get the one punch in. And you know, he even took a couple of monkey flips out of the corner, which is totally against his character. Because if you're legit, you don't take monkey flips, right? I mean, you don't take.
Sure.
Well, anyway, Tim Woods was whipping his ass pretty good, and Valentine was selling for him. And then suddenly Valentine grabbed, he hit him, knocked him down, grabbed his leg, and then fell backwards, twisting his leg. And Tim Woods grabbed his leg and started screaming bloody murder that he broke his leg. And Valentine stood over Tim Woods, who was screaming. The referee's trying to push him off. And Valentine's body language was that of a lion standing over Bambi. You know what I mean? It was like he's injured and he's proud he did it. And it was all in the body language. It was perfect. And then they did an interview with Valentine, and he like raised his voice and he said, "Don't ever bring anybody in here to embarrass me. You brought, I know who that guy is. That's Tim Woods. That's Mr. Wrestling. He's a big time wrestler, but he is going to be wrestling anymore because he messed with the wrong guy. And you don't try to embarrass Johnny Valentine." Now, okay. Now, there's your scenario, right? There's your scenario. This guy is the baddest guy in the world. And we saw him, you know, in two matches against Harley Race in Greensboro that went over 55 minutes where Valentine wins the U.S. belt. Okay. With like 56 minutes to go, they announced 5 minutes to go, whatever. And Valentine beats Race in some of the most incredible matches you ever saw. You know, would it fit now? I don't know. There was a lot of headlocks, a lot of work in the hold kind of stuff that was really kind
now,
of
just,
slow in the
John,
middle.
Just for context, tell me what kind of time frame we're talking about here. Were it early 70s or
this
what?
This is early 70s. This
okay.
is early 70s. 70,
okay, go ahead.
Maybe 73. And these two guys killed each other for like over 55 minutes. Valentine wins the belt. It's the first time a singles belt ever changed hands in Greensboro that anybody ever remembered. And the place exploded in cheering because Valentine had gained the respect of the people. He was the heel. But they brought Harley Race in as handsome Harley Race with blonde hair and a Hawaiian shirt. So nobody could like that guy, right? Anyway, Race is probably the only guy as tough as Johnny Valentine in my book. I mean, so they set this thing up where Valentine was just the baddest guy in the world. So in comes a match. They bring in the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes. This is before he's the American Dream, but he's still Dusty Rhodes. And Dusty Rhodes comes out. And, you know, we all was very fortunate because I got to see Florida on cable starting around 1970. I got to watch WWF out of D.C. I got to watch a lot of wrestling. So I knew that Dusty Rhodes was, you know, like a big deal. So they had a match, and it was one of the weirdest things because you knew something was wrong because Johnny Valentine got his ass kicked. I mean, he sold the whole match. And there was a disqualification because Dusty was beating his ass outside the ring. And, you know, Rhodes had boatloads of charisma. And so I think it was Tommy Young grabbed Valentine and was carrying him away from the ring. And Dusty jumped off the ring apron and hit him with an elbow in the back of his head, and Valentine went 4 to 5 rows flying into the crowd. And then Tommy came out and carried Valentine out. So as soon as that match is over, they announced there's going to be a rematch for the U.S. belt. Do you remember the U.S. belt was a touring belt? And it was going to be Johnny Valentine versus Dusty Rhodes, you know, the rematch. Now I knew something was up. Because Valentine never sold for anybody. I mean, it's hard to explain. He swung his forearm like a pendulum, and he would hit people with a forearm smashed across their chest and knock the wind out of them. Well, let me rechange that. He'd knock the life out of them. He hit them so hard.
But he expected he expected them to lay it back into him also.
Hell yeah. Yeah. You know, I got to interview Wahoo once, and Wahoo, I asked him, I said, what was the deal? And he said, all I can tell you is every time I got in the ring with the guy, He wanted to prove his manhood, and he wanted to prove your manhood. He said, I don't know if he hated football players or what. He said, but by God, he said, one time I got so tired of him beating my ass because every time we had a match, he would beat my ass and I had to fight back or he would just eat me up. And that was just the way he was. And he said he got so mad at him one time that he hauled off and tried to take his head off. He said, you know, like, screw it. I've had enough of this. I'm going to knock the shit out of him. And he hauled off with this chop and he hit Valentine. And Valentine staggered like 3 or 4 steps backwards and his eyes rolled back in his head. And then suddenly Wahoo looked down and said, Johnny Valentine had chili bumps running up and down his arms, chili bumps. And Wahoo said, I'm not going to say it was sexual. I don't know what the hell it was. He said, but Johnny Valentine loved contact. He was turned on by it. He lived for it. He said, and then he beat the shit out of me. I mean, you know what I mean? He said, he just killed me. And that was the guy's MO. I mean, it's hard to imagine now as you know, acrobatic and all that, everything is now, but then it was serious. So, okay, they had the big match. You know, here it is, Johnny Valentine versus Dusty Rhodes. And Dusty gets the offense for like the first 5 minutes. And then Johnny Valentine just crushes Dusty Rhodes. The booking on it, Jeff, was flawless. He beat Dusty Rhodes to death. And I mean, it was, the crowd was cheering for Dusty. Then the crowd was like, uh-oh, this is getting serious. And then the crowd started getting quiet, like, this is not right. And by the end, the crowd was screaming for somebody to come in and stop it because they thought Johnny Valentine was going to kill him. And, you know, back then, if you hit a suplex or you dropped an elbow, you could pin a guy, right? Johnny Valentine, and I counted it, dropped 17 consecutive elbows on Dusty Rhodes. And Dusty was bleeding from his shoulder. He was bleeding from his head. He was just, I mean, it was incredible. And he was a puddle of blood. Valentine even bit him in the shoulder to make it look so legit. And blood was flying. It was, and I'm not a juice guy, but I just remember sitting there going, this is scary. Dusty got on all fours trying to stand up. Valentine climbed to the second rope, jumped off and hit him with a elbow to the back of his head and knocked him flat. And Dusty didn't move the rest of the match. He didn't move. And Valentine just kept dropping elbows and dropping fists into his shoulder. It was nasty. And the referee, I think it was Tommy Young. I could be Sonny Fargo, but he went up to Valentine and he said, pin him. You know, they're doing the hand gestures, you know, just, you know, cover him, pin him. And Valentine stood over him and just shook his head. He said, no, I'm not going to pin him. I'm going to beat his ass. I'm just going to keep beating his ass. And he kept dropping elbows on him. And you're sitting there going, God almighty. I mean, it's grisly. And I wish I could tell you a comparison, but I really can't. But anyway, so what happened was the crowd is screaming. The place is packed. You know, back then, Greensboro would probably fit about, you know, 15,000. There was at least 14,000 people. This wasn't a pay-per-view. This was just a TV show. Not TV show. It's just a regular show. And Greensboro used to pack them in, buddy. Anyway, we're sitting there. I'm sitting there watching this shit, and the crowd's screaming for help. And then out from the back comes running Tiger Conway. And Conway comes running in. He's wearing his civilian clothes. You know, you never saw wrestlers wearing their, you know, their pants or, you know, hard shoes and shit. Well, he comes running in, and Valentine sees him, grabs him by that big afro, bends him over the top rope, hits him with the sledgehammer, then posts him, and Tiger Conway goes down in a heap on the floor. Valentine walks over and starts dropping elbows again on Dusty. Now, this is Dusty Rhodes, the biggest ego in the world, right? And he is setting up the Wahoo feud. That's what it's all about. He's setting this thing up. And he's been puddles of blood. And then suddenly out of the back comes running Wahoo. And Wahoo, it's funny what you remember. Wahoo's wearing loafers, brown pants, double knits, and no shirt. He comes barreling into the ring and starts chopping the shit out of Valentine, right? He had just gotten to the area within a couple of weeks. And they start trading on the outside. Dusty's just laying there. Of course, like I said, he's a mess. And they start trading. And then suddenly Valentine gets this look on his face like, I'm going to kill you. And he posts Wahoo. Wahoo hits a major gusher, blood flying everywhere. Wahoo staggers up, gets back in the ring, starts trading with him. And then out of the back, the crowd's screaming for more help. I mean, it's almost like a zoo. You know what I mean? And then suddenly out of the back comes running Ole and Gene Anderson. And you're like, holy shit. You know, they're the bad guys. Ole and Gene run in. They grab Wahoo and start whipping Wahoo's ass. And Ole does the old hand gesture, go get Dusty. And everybody knew the history that Ole and Dusty had feuded, you know, all over the place, right? You know, Georgia, Florida, you know, Texas, you know, those guys that had a history of not liking each other. And Jeff, I'm telling you, the Andersons started whipping Wahoo, and then they just let Valentine just continue to beat on Dusty, who was about in the middle of the ring, you know, and he kept pounding on him, hitting him, and dropping elbows on him. And then there was that lasted for a couple of minutes. And then suddenly out of the back room came every wrestler in the world, you know, Johnny Weaver, you name it, every baby face, a couple of heels even ran out to stop this thing. And then what happened was the Andersons are surrounding Valentine, and Valentine is pulling Dusty Rhodes across the ring. And the only way to explain it, and I said it in the book, it was a Steven Spielberg effect where he's dragging Dusty, and there's a smear of blood going all the way across the ring as he's dragging him and hitting him. All the wrestlers are throwing punches, and you can see Gene and Ole Anderson reaching out, grabbing these faces and hitting them with knuckles right in the face, you know, bam. And they're going down. The other guys are jumping in. They're surrounded. By then the crowd has lost it. They're all around the ring. They've jumped the fucking rail. You know what I'm saying? And they're trying to do something. Greensboro's finest police officers are surrounding that corner that they're going towards. And then all at once, Ole and Gene and Johnny Valentine jump out of the ring into a hail of fists and popcorn and drinks and people trying to kick their ass. And then Ole and Gene and Johnny Valentine fought their way with the help of the police surrounding them to the back room, to do the dressing room. And you can see, I mean, I'll never forget it I'm ranting, right? Johnny and Ole and Gene are reaching out and grabbing fans by the hair and hitting them in the fucking face. You know, I mean, just bam, bam. And they're fighting their way. And these fans are hitting them, and they fight all the way to the back. Now, by that time, Johnny Boy here had run down to the front row as close as he could, because I couldn't believe what I was watching, this thing. And it all was done. The sacrifice of Dusty Rhodes was done to set up the next big feud, probably the most legendary feud of the 70s, except the only thing that's probably bigger was Steamboat and Flair, right? But to set up Wahoo versus Johnny Valentine, and they did business like nobody's business. They sold everything out because those two guys would just, you know, every night would just beat the tar out of each other.
Folks, I'll just say this about my friend John Hitchcock. John, if nothing else, is a storyteller, and all you got to do is wind him up and let him go.
Well, I thought you were going to say, did you ever say a breath during that? I mean, I was on the floor, and two guys that were in charge of the ambulance walked up to me and said, is it time for us to go in? For some reason, these EMT dudes thought that I worked for Crockett, which is pretty fucking, you know, pretty stupid. And I went, no, just give it a minute. And then somebody from Crockett ran over and told him to go in, and they put Dusty on a stretcher and took him out.
Wow.
I mean, it was, and you think about the Mid-Atlantic in the 80s and how Dusty dominated everything, you know, every booking thing is all Dusty this and Dusty that. But to see that and see him being basically served up for slaughter to set up that feud was incredible.
Well,
it's really incredible.
And obviously, as you said, the program lasted for years and years, probably until Valentine's plane crash.
Yeah. Till the plane crash. And it's interesting, you know, Lou Thesz said in his book, the Hooker book, that he said, if Johnny Valentine knew any amateur wrestling at all, he would be the most dangerous man in the world because he was the toughest wrestler in the world. And, you know, I think Race is right there with him because, boy, Race is one tough guy.
Folks, stories like this and more can be found in John's book, Front Row Section D. It's available at Amazon.com. Of course, we ask you to use the tinyurl.com. And I'm going to ask you to tell one more story before we get into some of our top 100 matches that we want to discuss. John, tell the folks the story about the night that the Russians invaded the Greensboro Coliseum.
Well, that's kind of a two-pronged story, but I'll morph it into one just for you. The Russians, you know, Ivan, Nikita, and Crusher Khrushchev were a big, big deal. And I had met these two guys at the arena that were wearing Russian shirts with the hammer and sickle on the front, and then Ivan and Keaton, the Crusher, across the back. And I said, these are my kind of guys, right? And it turned out that they came into my comic book store. So anyway, I knew that I had allies somewhere, right? So I decided to go to the matches with a couple of guys, and we're sitting in the orange seats. And there's the classic, you know, true believer redneck family. You know, I can always recognize these people because, well, it takes one to know one. Anyway, I'm sitting there, and I decided to go and become a Russian immigrant. And that's what I was, you know, and I had a couple friends with me. And I walked in and I started doing, you know, the Ivan Koloff, you know, impression thing where I go, "It is good to be in Greensboro, North Carolina, to see my cousins and Uncle Ivan and Nikita and the only good American in this country, Crusher Khrushchev." Well, I thought people would start laughing. Guess what? They didn't. There was this old lady with her family, the husband and all the kids. And this lady turns around and starts going off. And it was so funny. It was so funny that once you had her on the hook, you couldn't let her off, right? So I was like, she's like, "I don't appreciate you sitting here on your butt cheering for the Ruskies." And I went, "Why are you giving me a hard time, old lady? I have green card. I come here to cheer for my friends and my colleagues, and you treat me so rudely. I do not understand your problem, old lady. You must be ignorant. You must be an ignorant old lady. You are old and stupid and ignorant." This lady starts going crazy. She goes, "I got a son who's fighting a war to make America safe. And you're sitting on your butt cheering for the Russians." "Well, why wouldn't I cheer for Russians, old lady? I am Russian. I am here from other country. I came from Leningrad and Stalingrad, and I'm here to cheer for Uncle Ivan. He is a good man. He is a good man." Of course, Ivan Koloff has been cheating forever. Yeah. This lady wouldn't let up. She started yelling. Then I suddenly noticed that behind her, her husband and her kids are laughing their ass off at her because they realize that I'm working her, right? But she doesn't get it. She's getting more and more angry. So finally, she starts talking about her son. She goes, "I got a son who's fighting a war." And I finally just snapped. And I said, "Do not worry, old lady. We will take over your country and we will have a good job for you in salt mines, because that's where ignorant people go, to work in salt mines." This old lady's getting more and more riled up. She's going crazy. So finally, I just said, "Do not worry, old lady. When I go back to Leningrad, I will make sure to shoot your son and I will bury him and I will drink vodka on his grave." By then, I think half my friends left because they knew I was going to get killed. But I decided that wasn't good enough, right? So I went back to wrestling and I sat in the end zone on the front row with a couple of friends. And what I did is I wore a long green coat with a red KGB button on it. And I goose stepped in and sat on the front row.
Well, of course, because if you're in the KGB, why shouldn't you wear a button identifying yourself as being in the KGB?
Well,
of course.
You got to give people a hint that they know what's going on. So I'm sitting there and I'm doing the Russian thing, right? And I'm talking about, you know, what great people the Russians are and, you know, blah, 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 and how they won the war and the Americans were cowards and shit. So I stirred it all up. Anyway, there was this lady behind me who went nuts and started screaming at me. "You know, you communist bastard, you should not be allowed in this. You should not be here. You know, you're the only person in this whole arena that is cheering for the goddamn Russians." And I looked at her and I said, "You are a stupid lady. And I will prove to you that there are more than me here cheering for the Russians." And I looked over and I saw the group of guys that were wearing the red, you know, communist shirts. And that was Billy Pritchett and Bud Grundy and a bunch of other guys that ended up becoming part of the front row. And I just stood up and I said, "Watch this, old lady." And I stood up and I pointed to them and then did a salute. And they all stood up and they saluted me. And then I stood and I looked and I pointed over to a group that my little brother had over here. I think my little brother was smarter than I was. He wouldn't sit with me because he knew that we were in the middle of the shit. He didn't want to get into that. So I stood up and pointed at that group, stood up and saluted. And that group stood up, started cheering. I said, "McCarthy was correct, old lady. We are taking over your stinking country. We are taking it over one wrestling show at a time, you stupid old lady." And man, that lady got so mad, she stomped out and got a ticket and sat somewhere else. It was fun. It was beautiful, man.
That's great.
I tell you, I told that story to Ivan Koloff and Winston, and Ivan was laughing, and Ivan said, "You know, if I'd have known you were doing that, we would have made you part of the act in Greensboro. We would have had you walk out with us one night."
let me just ask you.
I would have died and gone to heaven that would have been.
Let me just ask you, how often did they run Greensboro? Was it a weekly, a monthly? What kind of deal was it?
It was usually once a month. Of course, when the Crockett sold out for some stupid reason, TBS was running Greensboro like every week for TV tapings and stuff. And it got to the point where they just burned Greensboro down. I mean, we would go, but you could see the crowd slowly starting to shrink, you know, from 12,000 to 10,000 to 8,000. One time when the crowd,
the 70s and 80s, it was their hottest building, right? I don't think there's any question about that.
It makes sense. It makes sense. Greensboro, you know, went from 9,000 to like 15,000 to like 20,000 seats, right? I mean, you know, Charlotte was like 9,000 and, Raleigh's about 8,000. So if you're going to do something, go to the biggest building, you make the most money, right? I mean, that's why Greensboro was the hotbed. And, you know, it was just one of those things that, you know, one night we were sitting on the front row, you know, with our signs cheering for the horsemen and stuff. And Flair was in there for the main event, and Flair was, you know, suddenly looks around, and then suddenly, it's the only time he ever did this, Flair broke character, and he looked down right at me and he goes, "Where is everybody?" Because there was only about 6,000 people there, you know? And I just looked him right in the face, and he's in the ring looking down at me. And I looked at him. I said, "Dusty's booking sucks." And Flair just looks at me and he goes, "Yeah, I know, but this is embarrassing." I said, I looked at him. I said, "Don't worry. We'll start cheering and, you know, stir the place up." And he goes, "We need to do something." And then he took a couple of steps back and he went right back into the Ric Flair character, you know, which he is Ric Flair. So, but that's the only time I ever saw a reaction from him from watching the crowds, you know, start to fall apart. Biggest mistake they ever made was taking Starrcade out of Greensboro, because that was the home base, and the place was packed all the time for every show. And once they started, putting in Chicago and Atlanta and splitting and all that stuff, they just, you know, a lot of those fans took that personal and they just didn't come back.
Well, all I'm going to say is about that, don't get me started, because I could do a whole podcast just on how stupid that decision was. So anyway, so listen, John, what we're going to do, what we've done on a previous podcast, we're going to keep doing it today, is we look back on some of the top 100 matches of the 80s that I wrote about in the Observer Yearbook in 1989. So we're going to give you a couple matches, and you and I are going to discuss whether or not these matches hold up today. First one we're going to start with is the original War Games in Atlanta, July 1987. And tell me, John, if
prompt
you think
me a
this
little
match-
bit, brother, prompt me a little bit.
I got you. War Games. Original War Games. What'd you think? You think it still holds up?
Wasn't the original War Games down in Florida?
No, that was Cage. That was the second one after. It was like maybe a couple nights or a week afterwards, because the second one had Bubba dressed up as the War Machine. The original one was the one where JJ got hurt.
Oh yeah. Oh well, that match holds up. There's no doubt about it. But you know, the one thing that I think does hurt some of these matches in the long run is people nowadays could find them on YouTube or whatever. And watch them, but they don't have the build up. They don't know the psychology. They don't know the they don't know exactly how everything was set. So, but that was a great, great match. I mean, and those guys were all in their prime. I mean, they really, you know, you could tell that JJ was going to be the sacrificial lamb in that bunch. But yeah, does that hold up? Oh yeah, there's a real intensity to those guys. They really. Didn't you think it was always funny that the heels always won the coin toss? We used to bet guys. I bet you the heels win the coin toss. I bet you a drink. Okay, sure. Hey, we won. Go get me a sock. Go get me a drink, buddy.
Well, you know, the really amazing thing to me as I watched that match is you had 10 guys, and out of the 10 guys who were in that match, really like maybe three or four were really good. I mean, there were some really terrible wrestlers in there. I mean, you know, JJ was way, way past his prime, and Paul Ellering was never good. And Nikita was horrible. By that point, Dusty was pretty horrible. The Road Warriors, they were the Road Warriors, but it just shows how incredible Flair, Tully, and Arn were by that point, because they pretty much made the whole match. Because, you know, Luger, he never really did that much for me personally. He had a much better run a couple years later, but at that point, he was still kind of a stiff. So those three guys, Flair, Anderson, and Tully, they completely made the match.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the best wrestlers I ever saw were, you know, Ric Flair and Terry Funk. You know, those two guys are on Mount Olympus in my book. But I tell you, a guy that's not far behind is Tully Blanchard. If there ever was a born to be heel, it's Tully Blanchard. There's no way anybody could ever like that guy. He had that snotty look, that attitude. I mean, and boy, could he go. I mean, that's one of the things that kind of stands out in wrestling now, when you start thinking about guys like Ricky Morton and, you know, as far as guys that could sell, and Tully Blanchard, I mean, those guys grew up in the business. You know, they went from probably selling popcorn to putting up the ring to, you know, wrestling their matches when they were 14 or 15 years old. You know what I mean? Those guys, you can't replace guys like that that are from generations who just, they're so comfortable. But you got a valid point. I mean, the thing about Luger, and everybody dumps on Luger, and I have a soft spot for Luger a little bit, because I felt like Luger was being groomed, you know, and then what happened was they had him in a feud once with he was wrestling Steamboat.
Yes.
And you kept saying to yourself, well, he's going to learn everything from this guy, because Steamboat's one of the great sellers too. But then when he went up to WWE and was in the bodybuilding thing for a year, and then they put him in the ring, and then they did that Yokozuna stupid shit where they didn't put him over. They had it set to make him into something and give him a run, and then they bailed on it. And, you know, and then I'm pretty sure his attitude was, what they hired me for is this look. I'm going to do what I can do, and that's it. And there's a lot of wrestlers like that out there that, you know, they can do what they can do, and they don't try to do anything else because they don't want to look bad or get hurt or anything.
Well, you know, I always said that, you know, Luger's best year to me was always the end of 88 through the end of 89. And you sit there and you think about who he was working with. He was working with Flair. He was working with Steamboat. He worked some with Pillman. He was working with incredible talents who knew exactly what to do to put him over. And then he goes up, and of course he's working with, like you said, Yokozuna, who's the guy that Yokozuna's not Ricky Steamboat, folks. I don't know if I'm breaking any news to anybody there. Well,
now you're breaking kayfabe.
I really am there, boy. That's a news flash.
I got to talk to Luger once, and I said, you remember that night where with Bill Kazmaier, you know, because he brought Kazmaier in, and Luger just looked at me and he goes, Bill Kazmaier. He says, God bless Bill Kazmaier. At least there was one wrestler out there that was worse than me.
Well, anyway, listen, we're talking about Tully. The next match that we're going to go to that you may have been at, I'm not sure. Were you at the I Quit match with Magnum?
Yeah. Yeah. I was at that match, and it was really dark. I mean, it really had the ultimate edge to it. And the fans, when Tully broke that chair and tried to put the chair leg on Magnum, and the crowd went crazy. I mean, they loved that guy. I mean, he was over like nobody's business. And personally, I didn't like him just because I got tired of seeing a guy wrestle for 30 seconds with a belly to belly, and that would be it. And I go, how lazy is this guy? I mean, what the hell is that shit? You know, if you can wrestle, get out there and wrestle. You know, I mean, of course, the stuff Magnum did with Wrestling 2 down for Watts is legendary for the booking and the smarts of it and everything.
Sure.
Anyway, but that match was really incredible. Kind of in a way a slow burner a little bit, but the one thing that, you know, you talk about signs, the next show after that, I made a big sign that said Tully never quit, and I held that up during Tully's match, and Tully stopped, walked over, and he said, that's right, I never did quit. And I got hit with 6 drinks. People were throwing shit at that sign and trying to hit me and throw shit on me. And man, it was really, the heat back then was incredible. Everybody believed it, you know.
Well, you know, I tell you, totally. If you watch the match, not that this was the finish, but if they had Tully win that match, I don't know if he and Baby Doll get out of that arena alive, because holy cow, they wanted to kill those two before Magnum makes the comeback and gets the chair leg away from them.
Yeah, yeah, it's you know, like I said earlier, you know, if you don't know the whole buildup and everything, you might not quite get it. But if you know the buildup, that's one of the things that's wonderful about going to YouTube and seeing the big Dusty, the Dusty being turned on by Ole down in Atlanta in 1980, the cage match. They actually have the interviews, and the whole thing is right there. So you can see it, you know, exactly what happened. The interviews with Soley, they show the whole setup, which shows you what a big deal that was when it was the blow off.
Well, yeah. And speaking of things that were done very well and set up very well, my next match, Ricky Steamboat and Randy Savage from WrestleMania 3. I have people that still to this day claim this is the best match of all time. And I'll tell you one reason why it's not in my eyes. The program that was set up, the angle was tremendous. The match itself was great. The only thing that I hold against it is everyone's told me that apparently Savage sat down with Steamboat and said, okay, this is the way the match goes. And literally they wrote down every single direction the match or everything that happened in the match. They wrote it down word for word. I asked Steamboat personally face to face, and he said, absolutely, that's true. That's the way that Randy wanted to do it. Whereas he and Flair, when they have their matches, they go in and just sort of freeform it for 35 mm-hmm. minutes to an hour. And so I think that takes away a little bit, at least, you know, for me, that takes away a little bit. It's still a great match. There's no denying it.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
just
it's,
knowing
it's,
that.
It's, yeah. It's interesting, though, that if you watch that, if you watch that show from start to finish, that show is like Star Wars compared to everything else. You know what I mean? I mean, like two guys in their prime can go, can do anything. And they're just, you know, they're just going and they're going and they're going. And, you know, the legend is that's when Steamboat knew he was on the way out, because he made Hogan look like chopped liver with that match because he was just so good.
Yeah.
I often wondered if they put Steamboat in a rubber suit and had him spew gasoline just to try to bring him down to earth, because he really was something special.
Yeah, he was crazy good. And speaking of Steamboat, next match we're going to talk about is Ricky Steamboat and Tully Blanchard from Starrcade 84. Now, were you at that one?
Yeah, no, I was not at that match. I was not at that match, unfortunately. But I'll tell you something you don't know. There was a weird period in the, like 1990 where Steamboat and Tully Blanchard were, it must have been 90, but they both weren't working. And I got to see them in a gym in Burlington, North Carolina, and they tore the place apart. I mean, they went, it wasn't 300 people there, but they tore it down. They guys were incredible. I think, you know, there's certain Tully Blanchard and Bobby Eaton. And I mean, Bobby Eaton was an artist. I mean, Bobby Eaton was, we would sit there and watch it, and Bobby Eaton would do something, and we'd look at each other and go, have you ever seen that before? And we go, nope, that's a new one on me. That whole spot where they would hit him and he'd fall into the second rope and spring up and then throw a punch. I'd never seen anybody do anything like that. I mean, but yeah, Steamboat, you know, Steamboat was the ultimate babyface guy. And I got to talk to him once, not as long as you did, but I talked to him at one of the smaller shows. And I said, there's one thing that always bothered me about you, Steamboat. I said, I know you're a nice guy because you always sold for everybody. You sold for Charlie Fulton. You know what I mean? He sold for every jobber. I said, but here you are, this chiseled guy with the best body in, you know, at the time, one of the best bodies in wrestling. And somebody like George Two-Ton Harris would hit you in the stomach and you double over like you got hit with a bazooka shot. I said, I never quite understood why a guy as chiseled as you would, you know, would always have to sell for stuff like that, you know. But I guess it's just because you were trying to make him look good. And he said, well, yeah. And he was laughing like hell because he's like, you got a valid point there. I was like ripped, and I'm fighting guys with pot bellies who are throwing a punch, and I'm selling them and rolling around on the ropes going, oh, you know. So,
yeah.
Tully Blanchard, God almighty, the heat on him. Jesus Christ. I heard a story once that Tully Blanchard was there was a friend of mine was playing Miss Pac-Man at a 7-Eleven or something, and Tully Blanchard walked up and challenged the guy to a game of Miss Pac-Man, and Tully Blanchard beat the shit out of him and then started talking shit to him, but he walked away. He was that kind of competitive, you know. He's like one of the ultimate heel guys, and he didn't have to be like Ox Baker and have all the goofy hair. He didn't have to be, you know, he just was a badass. I mean, Baby Doll helped. I mean, there's no doubt about it. She was really good at her role. But Tully Blanchard could do, he was one of those guys, you know, his dad down in Texas and, you know, that guy knew the ring like the back of his hand. He was,
well, you know, he was the guy that was the quarterback for the football team. He was the guy that had, you know, if you think back to high school, the guy that probably had the sports car and had a little bit more money than everybody else in town and let you know about it. And he had that natural arrogance. I've called him before on the 605 podcast. I called him a low rent Flair because he never came off truly like that, you know, limousine riding, you know, jet flying guy like Flair did. He kind of came off like the guy that sponged the ride off that guy. And, you know, he had such a natural arrogance. And some guys you see, it's like a big put on. But some guys, it's not a put on. They're really that big an asshole. And that's the vibe that Tully definitely gave. And he was totally good at it. There's no question about it.
Just cocky, you know, I mean, so cocky. And, you know, and and strong. God almighty, you know, he was strong. But, you know, and then, of course, you know, my favorite wrestler of all time, you know, Arn Anderson, you know, Double A. I mean, whenever I see that guy, he'll go, "Hey, Greensboro, come over here." Of course, they never know my name. You know, Ricky Morton. "Hey, come over here, Greensboro." And I go, "Hey, yeah. How you doing?" And I say, "Rock and roll, brother." And he'd come over and he'd say, "I want to introduce you to somebody." He goes, "Hey, Robert, you remember Greensboro?" He goes, "Oh, yeah, that's the biggest asshole I ever met in my life. That guy had so much shit, I hate his guts." And I went, "Well, I love you too, brother." And he goes, "Yeah, great." And he kind of walks away, you know, turns his back. And then Ricky's laughing. He goes, "I want to introduce you to somebody." And it's like a rat, you know, a ring rat that was like, you know, 30 years ago or something. And he goes, "I want to introduce you to this guy. This is Greensboro. He used to make all these signs. He used to make fun of us. This guy's the biggest asshole you ever met." And I looked at and this lady looks at me like, "Are you going to let him talk to you like that?" And I'd look at her and I just go, "All I can say is everything he says about me that's bad, well, it was worse, okay? That's all I got to tell you." I had Ricky Morton throw a chair at me one time. That was funny as shit.
Tell everybody the story about what Ricky Morton said to you when he came down to you at ringside. He got out of the ring. He came up to you. You know what I'm talking about?
He said, "No.
I have had more." Take the rest of the story.
Oh yeah. That was the night. That was the first night that the pro wrestling tourist Bruce Mitchell sat on the front row, and we're sitting there on the front row, and out comes Rock and Roll versus, I don't remember who he was going up against, to be honest with you. And Bruce looked at me and he said, "Can they hear you? You know, we're on the front row, right? We're like 5 feet away from the ring." And he goes, "Can they hear you when you yell at them?" I said, "Well, why don't you find out?" And so Bruce stands up and he looks at the ring and he goes, "Hey, Morton, you suck." Ricky and Robert bolt across the ring and start screaming. And Ricky Morton goes, Hey, Four Eyes, I've turned down more pussy than you've gotten in your whole life just this one night." And Bruce looked at me like, holy shit, because he didn't realize the heat we had, right? Because we've been sticking these guys. So I'm sitting on the front row, and I'm like, I can't let this pass. I can't let this go. So I yelled out, "Hey, Morton, are we talking legal pussy here? Are we talking any of the teeny boppers and training bras and t-shirts, or maybe any farm animals you might have banged all the way to the arena? Because we don't know who the hell you're sleeping with." And when I said that, the team that was wrestling them started laughing, and Morton went nuts. And he's like, "You motherfucker." And he's like screaming like crazy. And so they start the match, and they started it weird because they had Gibson start the match. What was the name of that team that had we used to call the guy Woody. He looked like Woody Harrelson from Cheers. The two blonde guys, Tracy Smothers and
the Southern Boys?
The Southern Boys. I think it was okay. The Southern Boys. And they were laughing like crazy. And so I'm sitting there on the front row, and Ricky Morton doesn't start the match, which he normally did because he's the guy who sells, right? And Ricky Morton is on one knee, and he's screaming at me. And Bruce goes, "I had no idea it was like this." And I said, "Wait, I said, wait until Dusty comes out. I said, it gets worse. Dusty hates our guts, and we hate his guts." So, and he looks at me and he goes, "But man, Morton wanted to kill me." And I said, "You want me to get him going again?" And he goes, "Yeah, sure." And I kind of vaguely, you know, kind of quit talking to Bruce and kind of look over at Ricky Morton. And Morton is on one knee and he is screaming at the top of his lungs, "Suck my dick. You, suck my dick." And I looked at him and I went, "You want me to what? You want me to suck your dick?" I said, "Man, I'm into chicks. I'm not into dicks like you two. I know what you're doing in Motel 6. And I thought the guy was going to lose his mind. He was so mad. I never put that story in the book. And the reason why is whenever I see Ricky Morton, he always gives me a hug and tells me he loves me.
I can't imagine why Robert Gibson doesn't want to talk to you.
He used to make fun of his eyes.
Anyway. Yeah, that'll get it going. Yeah. So, all right, last match we're going to talk about. Eddie Gilbert, Terry Taylor versus Sting and Shane Douglas in the Battle of New Orleans. And we are talking June 1st, 1987. Now, of course, what's interesting about this match is Shane Douglas is listed as one of the participants. But when it really starts getting good, Shane kind of is on the floor and Chris Adams comes in. Do you remember this match from the UWF?
No, I do not remember that one. You're going to have to take it, baby.
I'm going to take the lead on this one, brother. So what happens is Eddie and Terry Taylor are just doing some great heel work. They take it outside the ring. They go over where they just happen to have this convenient beer stand where they would never have a beer stand. Go figure. And the trash cans start flying. Sting gets a hold of a beer keg, throws a beer keg at Eddie Gilbert. Eddie Gilbert gets beer spilled over him, and they're all sliding over the place. It was sort of a low-grade Tupelo concession stand. It wasn't, Yeah, there's no Tojo getting slapped by the owner's wife. But it was great fun, great stuff. It holds up. You know, so much of what we see nowadays is being copied. You have, you know, the groups in Japan. You have local independents. And they try to do these just ridiculous gimmick matches, you know, with light fixtures, barbed wire, nails, tacks. And it loses so much of it because it doesn't have, you know, if you just have a gimmick there just for the sake of a gimmick being there, it loses something. You know, it has to mean something when Tojo and the guys are in the concession stands with Eddie and Ricky Morton, and they're hitting each other and throwing mustard on one another. Mm-hmm. It was there, so it had a reason. That was one of the things I thought was funny about the Battle of New Orleans was, well, what's this beer stand doing there? It's, you know, nobody ever has a beer stand right in front of the crowd. It was like, you know, and it was nobody monitoring the beer stand. So apparently they had closed. Yeah, beer sale's going to end early tonight, folks. But still a great match from, I think it said July 1st, 1987. It's out there on YouTube. It's Sting and Shane Douglas versus Eddie Gilbert and Terry Taylor. Give it a watch. Still holds up as a great match and great fun.
You know, what's funny is when you talk about things that suddenly stand out, you know, I got the opportunity to talk to Gordon Soley a couple of times.
Okay.
And Soley was at a hotel bar in Baltimore or something. And I went over and said, could I talk to you? And he said, sure. And so he's having his cocktail and I went up and talked to him and I said, you know, one thing that I always thought was great is the fact that, you know, here you are down in Florida and you're there all the time. Right. And he goes, oh yeah. Yeah. And I said, and then suddenly, mysteriously, a telephone would appear on your desk. And the telephone wasn't there, you know, half an hour before the show. And the telephone wasn't there, you know, for the last 6 weeks. But suddenly a telephone would suddenly mysteriously appear on your table, you know, your announcing table. And, of course, it would ring. And then you pick it up and go, well, this is highly unlikely. I tell him to hold my calls, blah, blah, blah. And then he goes, what? What? Huh? What? Oh, such a car wreck. What? Huh? What? And Soli just started laughing like crazy. He goes, man, I forgot about the phone. He said, that is a really good point. We only brought the phone out when it was going to ring. It was never there unless it was going to ring.
Or if NWA President Bob Geigel was making a phone call to Gordon personally to discuss something.
Geigel. So. Anyway.
Well, anyway, listen, we're going to do a little transition here. John, for those of you that don't know, is the owner of a very famous bookstore in Greensboro, North Carolina, Parts Unknown, the bookstore.
That's right.
For all your comic book needs. So it made me wonder, John, episode or two ago, we discussed movies. We like to talk about movies here on this podcast. So tell me, of all the comic book movies that have been made, you got your Batmans, your Supermans, your Spider-Mans. Tell me your favorite comic book movie.
The Incredibles.
Really?
I think The Incredibles is like the way the Fantastic Four movie should be. It's got a sense of humor to it. It's smart. I think The Incredibles is right there. Of course, the Heath Ledger Joker Batman is kind of, you know, I don't know. It's really incredible stuff. What he did and playing that role was so original. I mean, and it's a shame that he passed, but.
So how would you compare his performance to Nicholson when Nicholson did the Joker?
Nicholson played it as a cartoon with an edge. You know, cause he's wearing suits and stuff that are all nice and neat and kind of like, you know, purple and in the character, but he looks a little bit like too much like a cartoon, where Heath Ledger's Joker looked like he crawled out of the gutter somewhere. Yeah. He was like a homeless guy or something. There's a darkness to that. That's really,
oh, no question. He has a much darker edge to the character.
The very first Christopher Reeve, first two Christopher Reeve Supermen, are wonderful movies to watch. They do some things that are kind of strange, like Superman reversing the earth and shit like that. But still they're, you know, he is the perfect cast for the role of Superman. I think some of the greatest superhero stuff of all time is the Warner Brothers cartoons, the Superman, the Justice League, the Batman cartoons. I think those things are incredible.
Sure.
Bruce Timm and the animator is a friend of mine, and he's one guy I always wanted to meet. And I told him, I said, dude, I said, if I was a kid, I said, you know, your Batman and Justice League stuff would be my Johnny Quest, buddy. I mean, that's, the stuff's incredible.
Well, I always said that any guy that grew up in the general time frame that you and I were kids had to have Johnny Quest and Speed Racer on their go-to list for cartoons.
And Space Ghost. I mean, yeah. I was always loved. Space Ghost always had an interesting sense of humor to it, too. I was really good friends with Alex Toth, who was the head character designer at Hanna-Barbera. And I wrote a book with him about all the letters and stuff he sent me. It was nominated for an Eisner Award, which is like, you know, the Academy Awards of comic books.
Nice.
I didn't win. I lost. I had a $20 trade paperback, and I lost out to a $50 hardcover.
So those bastards.
Deluxe. Yeah, I know. I mean, who does Brian Bolland think he is? You know, he did the Killing Joke. Give me a break. I mean, you do better than that. Anyway,
what do you, let me ask you, what do you think of my favorite? I think I was thinking about this last night. My favorite comic book movie, I'm going to say Captain America, the First Avenger. What do you think? Did you like that one?
You know, that stuff's incredible. Both those are. The Avengers movies are fun. It's worth sitting through the first Avengers movie to see Loki and Hulk fight, which lasts a second, you know, boom, 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 exactly what would happen. Yeah, the Captain America stuff's great. Avengers stuff's great. I mean, you know, all that stuff's great. And, you know, they moved DC Comics out to California so they could be, you know, like near the movie people. So when they do a screenplay, they run the stuff by the editors and the writers that are there to make sure that it kind of works, you know, so the fans won't be disappointed.
I'll tell you a funny story. My son is a huge Marvel guy. He gets all the, you know, the hardbound books, encyclopedias and the histories of the characters and stuff like that. Will not watch a DC movie.
Huh?
He is hardcore Marvel boy. You can't drag him down to a DC movie. So, well, listen, John, that's just about wrap it up for this week's show. Appreciate everybody listening.
Well, I appreciate it, brother. Anytime you want me, just call me. And it's really an honor to be on your show.
Thanks okay, folks. Folks, let me tell you, you can follow me on Twitter at Baldrin Jeff. Breaking Kayfabe, still available, crowbarpress.com. And I want a special thanks, shout out to my friend Brian Last and the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. John's book that I mentioned, Parts Unknown, is his comic book store. The book is Front Row Section D. And until next time, for my friend John Hitchcock, this is Jeff Baldrin, Breaking Kayfabe. We'll see you next time, folks.